exploiting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we'll hear updates on various grassroots activist issues, from climate liability and indigenous rights to the importance of whistleblowers and independent investigative journalism. We'll also discuss the overall state of the media. We're joined today by artist and writer Eleanor Goldfield of Act Out and ArtKillingApathy.com. We'll also be joined by journalist Kevin Gostola of Unauthorized Disclosure and ShadowProof.com. Stay tuned. Welcome to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are delighted to welcome back to the show Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist, poet, singer, and writer. She's creator and host of the activist news show Act Out on Free Speech TV, also Occupy.com. And she is author, most recently, of a book, Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift. You can find her work at ArtKillingApathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, welcome back to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Eleanor, we had you on the program early December, late last year, and it was actually one of our most listened to shows, and so we're very delighted to have you back on, and apparently a lot of our listeners were happy to hear what you're doing, and so we have you back to give us an update. So remind people what you're doing and about your program and where they can learn more, and then let's talk about a few issues.
Basically, what I do is, you mentioned creative activism. So in terms of the show covers a wide range of topics, mostly things that the corporate media will never touch, which is a lot of things. And on top of that, we talk to people on the ground, be it creative activists, artists, singers, poets, visual artists, documentary filmmakers, but also people that just creatively think outside the confines of capitalism. So people who do urban gardening or people who do community programs or community outreach that are things that being a good pro does not teach you how to do. So people that are building and fighting simultaneously. So we have a lot of people on the show that build, not just people in the United States, but also people from around the world. We've had people from northern Syria, from the Rojava revolutions happening there, Egypt, Australia, et cetera, et cetera. So that's the show. And then outside of that, I do spoken word performances that blend spoken word along with projected visuals. And I try to go to a lot of these places that have frontline battles, such as pipeline resistance camps or places that are dealing with what it means to be at the short end of the capitalism sticks. I guess that's it in a nutshell. And so, like last time, we talked about pipelines, which is something that I've worked a lot on, the prison industrial complex, the military industrial complex, all of these lovely complexes that sit under the larger umbrella of the capitalist system.
That's quite a list of things that you do. And of course, topics that we cover here at Project Censored, you noted that the corporate media don't really cover these issues in depth or in detail. And one of the issues that you mentioned was about pipelines. And I know that you and I had spoken earlier, and you were talking a little bit about the Enbridge pipeline and abuse of women and girls. That was a recent story that you're following.
The Enbridge Line 3 is the pipeline that's being proposed. Right now, it's on hold until June of 2018. I actually had some indigenous youth on my show late last year to talk about the indigenous resistance to this pipeline, because it'll be going through, of course, as usual, predominantly indigenous lands, and a lot of the rice fields in the area of Minnesota that are very important, not just, of course, for food and livelihoods, but also in terms of ceremonies and the sacred land for the indigenous people that live there. So that's kind of the main story that we hear on environmental blogs and in alternative media, but something that kind of gets lost in this shuffle, in this fight against the pipelines, is something called man camps. So basically, man camps are camps of transient workers that are basically just brought in to work on these fossil fuel projects. And they're predominantly transient workers who come in for a short amount of time, get paid a lot of money, and then leave. And for years, they've left in their wake not just a destroyed earth, but also sex trafficking and the drug trade and the rape and disappearance of an untold number of indigenous women. And one of the reasons that it's an untold number is because there isn't actually a comprehensive system for keeping track of the amount of indigenous women and girls who go missing or die or are raped. One of the reasons that this is because in terms of tribal sovereignty, these organizations are supposed to work together. It's supposed to be the tribal authorities, the federal authorities, and the local authorities, but they don't. It's a complete mess of bureaucracy. And a lot of this falls on the fact that the federal government has not given the tribal authorities access. For example, only in 2010, could tribal authorities even prosecute non-natives for domestic violence. And the majority of domestic violence cases were non-native men assaulting native women. And the tribal courts still can't prosecute rape or assault, only domestic violence cases and domestic assault. So the federal government has perpetually kept the indigenous and tribal lands away from accessing the tools and resources to properly prosecute and properly deal with this problem. A few tribes, a measly, 10 tribes or something, were supposed to be part of a program that was created under the Tribal Law and Order Act of 2010, I believe. The Tribal Access Program for National Crime Information back in 2010. 10 tribes were supposed to be a part of it, but for example, the Tulalip tribe in 2015 announced that they had still not gotten access to the NCIC database, and even that they had offered to pay for it themselves. And this was part of a DOJ program that was supposed to try and streamline how tribal authorities and tribal communities could deal with these issues, predominantly, of course, surrounding indigenous women and girls. And there's still no comprehensive database. They still don't have access to this information, to national crime databases for these, again, predominantly non-native men who come in here, come into the tribal lands and destroy both people and planet and then leave. And they know that there's no jurisdiction that will take care of them. Federal authorities do have the ability to prosecute rape, but they hardly ever do because it's just not a priority for them. So this is a really big issue, and it's something that a few groups and a few people have started to speak out against, but it's still a huge problem in these indigenous areas.
Well, Eleanor Goldfield, a remarkable and tragic story that we don't hear much of at all surrounding the man camps, worker camps, the pipelines. Sounds like we have multiple issues going on here. Of course, we have the sort of a capitalist colonial or settler colonial kind of mentality, not only in terms of raping of the earth and fossil fuels, and then, of course, stacking on top of that the history of Western encroachment on indigenous lands. Now we're adding yet another patriarchal component of occupation of women and women's bodies. And now that we're living in our media-addled culture, we're subject to the Me Too campaign, which, of course, mm-hmm. has unearthed so many important things on one level and sort of coming out. But there's also this infatuation in the corporate media of the gotcha whodunit celebrity status issue. Like, well, who's going to be the next one to fall? Rather than looking at the entire systemic patriarchal hegemonic culture itself. And here is a real deep-seated example in these man camps. And you mentioned that the DOJ isn't going about prosecuting a lot of these things that are happening. We know in Project Censored, we did stories on unprocessed rape kits. So just in that kind of a context, can you sort of riff through how these dots of oppression are connected?
Yeah, I mean, you make a really good point. I mean, the Me Too movement is seeing a lot of people being thrown out of their places of power, and rightfully so, for sexual assault and harassment. But the overarching majority, again, like the 99% of women and girls who have experienced this are not as important as, for example, a celebrity who experiences it. And even then, black and brown women experience this on a different level because you add the issues of racism and white supremacy and then, of course, indigenous women. The 500 years of colonial settlerism that still perpetuates to this day, I mean, Casey Camp Hornick, who is an incredible indigenous woman leader and has fought against a lot of dirty energy pipeline projects, said that they came with the smallpox blanket, and now they come with bulldozers. So it's a sort of perpetuation of this colonial mentality that we can just come into these places and take whatever we want. And most of these workers are white men, so it's not really a big shift in the demographics either. And I think that this story in particular just shows again how not important these issues are, not only in terms of the women being hurt, but really placing that blame at the feet of the corporations who perpetuate it, because it's big oil. It's big oil and gas that are throwing these men into these man camps and just giving them money and saying, hey, do whatever you want. And I think in response to one of these complaints, one of the companies said, oh, we're going to do trainings, you know, about like sensitivity trainings or something like that.
What kind of training? Like, don't rape people?
It's probably more about like how to be a little more quiet about it so that people get off our case about this because it's making us look bad. That's really what the big corporations care about. They don't want anything that will interfere with their process of extraction, whether that be extracting resources from the earth or, you know, extracting something that they want from the women that they come into contact with. If the corporations really care, that they could do something about it, obviously. But they don't. And local authorities, again, because of this absolute mess of how these authorities work together, or rather don't work together, the men staying at the man camps, again, they know that they don't have anybody that's going to come down on them. It's not their boss that's going to come down on them. It's not any local or federal or tribal authority that's going to come down on them. So it's really, it's a free-for-all, and it's almost like going back to this idea of the Wild West, where the white men can just go and take whatever they want from these indigenous communities.
I was just thinking that, Eleanor Goldfield, and particularly in historical context, you go back to the Trail of Tears, or we go back however far we go with these forced relocations and colonialism in U.S. history or prior British colonial history, or many other European colonies, of course, by the way. But of course, in the more recent past, I couldn't help but recall Standing Rock, shooting water cannons at people in freezing cold weather, jamming cell signals so people couldn't communicate, yeah. Police coming from multiple states. I mean, this was just a full-on assault against these water protectors.
There were several comparisons made to what happened. Was it Bundy, I think? Takeover of federal government land, and no shots are fired, no dogs are sicked on anyone, no tear gas, no water hoses in sub-zero temperatures. But people trying to protect their land that is not only protected under the fact that it's their sacred land, but it's also treaty land, well, no, they have to be shown a lesson because they're indigenous and they're standing in the way of white European patriarchal progress.
It's almost difficult to imagine that corporate media might cover these kinds of issues. I mean, they didn't cover Standing Rock for a long time. And then when they did, they had certain spin or angles on it. And certainly the case you're talking about, the man camps. Have you seen any significant coverage of this outside of maybe some of the local areas?
Not at all. There's no larger conversations about this. And I'm sure that the argument would be, well, that's local news. Well, this isn't just happening in that area in Minnesota. This isn't a problem that has happened all over the places that are dealing with the Bakken oil fields, which includes the Keystone, DAPL, the upcoming Line 3, which hopefully doesn't get the okay. But this has been a problem around that area for a long time. So this is nothing new, and people could easily, I mean, media could easily have gone in and gotten the story from the ground there, but it's not a point of interest. Because again, you know, as you and Project Censored do a great job of exposing, the people who pay the bills of corporate media are the same people that are drilling and fracking. So they're not interested, even things like NPR, National Petroleum Radio, they're not interested in shining a light on these issues because these are their meal tickets are coming from these same corporations.
Right. And of course, that kind of analysis, sort of a critical media literate analysis, looks at the propaganda model, ownership, advertising, reliance on sourcing. Another one of the things that we do at Project Censored, while highlighting a lot of great intrepid independent journalists, including the work that you do, we're trying to teach people how to read through the news and see behind the headlines so that people can be empowered to ask their own critical questions and turn off corporate news media and really turn on truly independent free press work. And again, there's really a lot of it. It kind of strains the imagination at times when we say like, well, gee, there's an awful lot of time to be covering Donald Trump's latest inane tweet. But if these folks at these newsrooms would only just pick up a copy of a Project Censored book or go online to the many different blogs and independent sources and podcasts and shows like yours as well, Act Out, there's plenty of stuff to cover. And it's not that these people don't know that there isn't. It's just the structural system of journalism has just been completely co-op. And as you said, it's the same people that are drilling that are paying the bills and profits over in big media. And that's a major part of the problem.
I try to think of it like on the perspective of an organizer, because that's something that I do as well. And I basically think of it from the perspective of, is this story going to help the people that it's about? Is this story going to help get the truth out about an issue that's important that people need to know about? or not. And if it's not, then why am I covering it? And it's the same thing with like the Trump thing that you mentioned. That's not helping anybody. That's not going to help anybody that doesn't have health care, that is struggling with sexual assault, that is struggling with poverty. It's not going to help anybody if I cover that. So why? Plus the fact, of course, as you mentioned, everybody else is covering it too. There's no new angle to cover. I did want to correct myself. The allowing tribal courts jurisdiction over a limited number of domestic violence and dating violence cases, that advancement came in 2015, 2 years after they reauthorized the Violence Against Women Act. That was one of the new pieces of legislation in there. But again, that does not allow the tribal court to prosecute non-natives for rape or assault.
I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. Right now, we're speaking with writer, artist, poet Eleanor Goldfield, host of Act Out on Free Speech TV. And after this brief musical break, we'll continue our conversation. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. On today's program, we are joined by Eleanor Goldfield. She's a creative activist, a poet, a singer, and a writer. Her recent book is titled Paradigm Lost, Radical Verse and Visuals for the Shift, with a foreword by Lee Camp and a whole host of artists and contributors in there, including, of course, Eleanor Goldfield herself. Her show is called Act Out. You can see that on Free Speech TV and Occupy.com, and you can learn more about her work at ArtKillingApathy.com. Eleanor Goldfield, just before the break, we were talking about a host of interconnected issues, including pipelines and fossil fuels, man camps, rape culture, Me Too, Trump's tweets, were all these things kind of people maybe saying, wow, there is a strange connectivity between what's going on around here and what corporate media do and don't do. I wanted to flip a little bit, and instead of only focusing on, hey, look at these really horrible things that are going on that the corporate media ignore, there's also some really interesting things, positive things, good things that have been happening the last couple of years around some of these issues, certainly with climate change, sort of moving off of fossil fuels. One of those stories, actually, we covered in the Censored 2018 book, and that was how there are young plaintiffs now that are invoking constitutional grounds for climate protection, and about how young people and millennials were looking at suing, filing lawsuits against the federal government and fossil fuel industry in U.S. federal court. This is something that I know you were also following. And quite recently in New York, we found news that the city is planning to sue five oil companies for climate change damages. Could you talk a little bit about that, Eleanor Goldfield?
The issue of climate liability is one that is popping up more so in the news now, but it's one that's actually been happening around the world for quite some time. And that is kind of what Bill de Blasio did January 10th, I believe it was. He issued a statement saying that not only was New York going to divest the $5 billion it had in over 190 fossil fuel companies in the next 5 years, but that also along with that, that he was going to sue the five largest oil companies for knowing about climate change, perpetuating it, and then doing nothing to protect the people and the cities that are suffering the greatest from it. And of course, New York, after Hurricane Sandy, suffered $19 billion in damages, which is interesting enough what the city is now asking for in order to bolster the city for upcoming and ongoing storms that they will doubtlessly have to deal with. So the idea behind this is that, yes, of course, the fossil fuel companies have known for a long time the issue of Exxon knowing about climate change way back in the 80s and then deciding to cover it up because it just didn't fall in line with their profit margins. They have their own research departments. They know. And you see a lot of fossil fuel companies, even now, they're starting to shift to green energy as well, not because they care, but because it's more economically feasible. So they're going to start shifting, again, not because they care about people and planet, but because it makes more sense for the profit margins. But this step by de Blasio is an important step because New York is the largest city to do this. And I believe that Sacramento and Oakland also announced that they were divesting from fossil fuels. And Seattle divested from Wells Fargo, which happened around the same time that the DAPL was going through. And Wells Fargo was a big financial bolster for the Dakota Access Pipeline. So we see these sort of divestment movements and climate liability movements happening, and on a lot of different scales as well. For example, the Juliana versus the United States was a climate lawsuit that was brought in 2015. And basically, the complaint was that through the government's actions that caused climate change, they're violating the youngest generation's constitutional rights to life, liberty, and property, as well as a failure to protect the public trust resources. There's actually a court date coming up on February 5th as well for this. And so this issue of climate liability is one that's happening more and more. Of course, New York is just on a much larger scale. And New York City actually bringing in a lawsuit against five oil companies is great and hopefully sets the stage for more of the same.
Right. And we do see San Francisco, Oakland, Santa Cruz, and California doing this. Again, we mentioned earlier Exxon and Shell. That also includes Chevron that has a home here mm-hmm. in the San Francisco Bay Area. It's a classic example, in fact, of environmental racism, where they have the highly polluting refinery in minority-dominant Richmond, California, north of Berkeley. And they have their offices over in the suburbs of San Ramon. But this is a fantastic development in terms of a global social justice kind of story. It's also story number 17 in Censored 2018. That story actually made the top 25 in our book last year. So it's very good to see an update and good to hear that there's still more momentum taking place around this issue. Eleanor Goldfield, let's shift to one other topic. Of course, the media. We were sort of riffing a little bit on the media earlier, mentioning sort of the focus on the Trump tweets and the slight focus or shift in the Me Too movement away from women and victims and sort of looking at a gotcha celebrity issue. One of the other things, and we can't say on air, one of the president's recent tweets, and we won't spend a lot of time on this, not a tweet, but a comment that he's now denying, referring to countries and immigration. But that's a sort of a segue into this conversation a little bit about immigration and what's going on with DACA, Dreamers. Right now, we're seeing wholesale ICE raids across the U.S., raiding 7-Eleven stores and so forth. And all that kind of stuff comes on the heels of this comment the president made about not great countries and slurred a lot of countries, Haiti, El Salvador, African countries. And again, one with any kind of historical knowledge or context here could say that a lot of these places that you're mentioning have been ravaged by Western colonialism and by corporate capitalism. And a lot of people come to the United States from these countries in the wake of the disaster that is oft left there. Anything you want to chime in about those ongoing issues?
I think it's important to note that our particular brand of imperialism or, you know, freedom crusades, as we like to say, bringing freedom all over the world, has created these type of countries that produce refugees. And no, we haven't taken our freedom crusades to Norway. So that, plus the reason that Norway has free health care, free education, paternity and maternity leave, the people whose countries we are destroying are actively trying to get over here. I mean, just thinking about, you know, you mentioned El Salvador. Well, guess who has a history there? The school of the Americas. So these countries that we systematically destroy, that we try to take down from the inside, whether it be staging a coup, whether it be economic sanctions, whether it be the School of the Americas and that particular brand of terrorism, whatever the case may be, we destroy these countries and then blame the people that are trying to flee and search for safety. That, of course, as you mentioned, is what's underlying the issue with that commenter, but that's not brought up by the mainstream of the corporate media. It's stuff that, you know, things like Project Censored bring up, and alternative media. These are the underlying issues that people need to understand, because people don't come to this country because things are going great where they are. That's why you don't have Norwegians. People actively come to this country because things are going horribly there. And if you look at, we have 1,000 bases all over the world. And guess what? Just in the past decade, our work with AFRICOM in Africa has perpetuated and contributed to so much turmoil there that, yeah, you're going to see an influx of refugees from that area, too. I mean, if you look at it, it's not that difficult to connect the dots to migration refugees coming to this country and our imperialistic, war-hawkish policies in these countries. It's actually a pretty easy exercise.
And of course, we've written about AFRICOM for years at the project. And of course, Nick Peirce, one of our top stories from the last couple of years, about 1,000 military bases, special ops going on. I mean, you know, the U.S. is in, you know, 3/4 of the world, basically, or more, with these kinds of special ops and ongoing things. But, you know, all of the things that we're talking about, Eleanor Goldfield, could be the things that are talked about instead of one of the FCC banned words dating back to the George Carlin days, right? Blank hole countries, right? We're not allowed to say this because of the FCC. But apparently, I was talking to our producer, Dennis, before the show, and he was saying that on CNN the other day, he saw them just throwing down the word willy-nilly, like it was almost some kind of party that they could now say this word because the president said it. And certainly we've seen some great guerrilla artwork at projecting these things on his hotels and so on. That's Schadenfreude moments. But let's again remember that these are the things that take up massive amounts of media airtime and column space instead of any of the things that we were just discussing and what you were just talking about in terms of migration, immigration, foreign policy.
Yeah, exactly. And I think people call me, you know, a humbug and, oh, you're so depressing. You just want to pay attention to the depressing stuff all the time. And I said, no, I don't. I think it's great that people are projecting, you know, that message onto Trump Hotel. I think that's brilliant. But by perpetuating these sort of shallow messages and also by giving Trump that stage, I think this is also the bigger problem, is that we're giving him so much attention by focusing on this. Not that you should ignore his ability to do harm, but by focusing on these sort of shallow messages, you're bringing yourself down to that level, basically. You know, there's talk about, like, you know, what should people do for the State of the Union? Oh, we should do a live rebuttal. No, don't. Don't respond to that. Like, if a kid's throwing a temper tantrum, you don't get down on the floor and go, oozy, boozy, boozy. You're like, okay, you need to stop. And then, you know, when you're done having a fit, then we can figure this out.
You don't feed the tantrum behavior. But he noticed that Trump is getting what he wants. He's getting nonstop coverage. He's getting more and more attention for these utterly absurd statements. And the media, they buy right into it, hook, line, and sinker, the corporate media. And meanwhile, they still are not covering key issues that matter. And even though, you know, what we saw at the Golden Globes not long ago, the solidarity movement, the Me Too movement, the moving speech from Oprah Winfrey. But all that we get out of that is Oprah for president. Then that runs out and spins in the ditch. And then we're also then not talking about the key issues once again. The corporate media, they can't seem to find the story, even if it's right in front of their faces.
Well, yeah, and of course, that's, as you and Project Censor pointed out, that's all by design. It's a lot better to sit and have a roundtable discussion as to whether Oprah Winfrey's dress means that she's good enough to be president or not. It's a lot better to sit and talk about that than to talk about, you know, what's going on in Haiti and how that is connected to the Clinton Foundation and what's going on, still going on in Puerto Rico, that's still going on in Flint. Like, these are stories that don't get high ratings. And, you know, part of that does fall on us, the public. And I think, you know, one of the things that I try to do is not just say, oh, bad corporate media, bad media, because at the end of the day, we are consuming this. We are consuming this fluff. And we might complain about it over a beer, but unless we are actually looking at it and saying, you know what, I'm not going to consume that anymore. I'm not going to play into that tantrum, it'll continue. So I think a lot of this falls on our shoulders, not just as journalists, of course, but as citizens, to actively say that we're not going to be a part of this. We are going to be part of the movement that fights this sort of thing and that builds an alternative instead, and to throw our energy and our attention behind alternative media and the people that are actually doing real work and the people that actually need our help, and so that we don't pay attention to the fluff and the shallow nonsense.
Absolutely. And again, Eleanor Goldfield, there are so many people doing great journalistic and free press work, and so many young people, and particularly another thing that we don't see much of, we don't see a lot of focus, even in progressive movements and in left movements, we don't see enough of the focus on young women and people of color that are on the front lines telling these stories and doing this work. And, you know, Project Censored, in addition to lauding and highlighting the good work that people like you and others are doing, we're also really interested in teaching critical media literacy as a serious public educational program. So, as you said, people can turn off corporate media and they can begin finding these alternatives that do exist and other stories and narratives are being told. So, Eleanor Goldfield, thank you so much again for joining us on the Project Censored show.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you so much for all that you and Project Censor do. It's such important work.
And you can learn more about Eleanor Goldfield at artkillingapathy.com. Up next on the program, we'll turn our attention to another independent journalist. That would be Kevin Gostola. Please stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. In this segment of the program, we're going to interview independent journalist Kevin Gostola. Kevin Gostola is the co-host of Unauthorized Disclosure with Rania Kalik. He is managing editor of Shadowproof.com. He was previously a staff columnist and reporter for FireDogLake.com. Kevin's work has appeared in The Guardian, The Nation, Salon, Alternate, and Common Dreams, and he's appeared on Democracy Now!, Counterspin, The Young Turks, Uprising, The Majority Report, and Huffington Post Live. He has also been featured in several Project Censored works, including most recently Censored 2018, highlighting his work with Unauthorized Disclosure. And several years ago, Kevin Gostola had the number one censored story with his coverage of the Chelsea Manning trial. Kevin Gostola, welcome to the Project Censored Show.
Thank you.
So, Kevin, let's just reintroduce your important work to the Project Censored audience. I'm pretty sure that our listeners know your work, especially because of the journalism you've done around whistleblowers and whistleblowing. But feel free to tell our listeners about some of the work you're doing both at Shadowproof, but also with Rania Kalik at Unauthorized Disclosure and where people can find out more.
So to start off, the work around Chelsea Manning continues. Currently, I'm looking at the upcoming reality winner trial that should be happening this year at some point. And there's a lot of issues to get into with that and ways in which her case compares to Chelsea Manning that I see as a continuation of my work. And like you mentioned, the piece in the most recent book from Project Censored, your annual book, I contributed along with my co-host Rania Kalik, who is currently based in Lebanon. She and I wrote about our podcast and what we're doing and building a space where we can include more dissenting voices in media, but also expand the spectrum debate. It's not just about finding new voices, but also finding ways in which we can have conversations that are beyond what is okay and acceptable on Twitter, beyond what is okay and acceptable on your Facebook page, beyond what's acceptable in the establishment or corporate media outlet.
And your partner in crime at Unauthorized Disclosure, Rania Kalik, we certainly would love to have Rania on a future program, but you know, her work in the Middle East, Syria, Libya, she writes about a great many of these issues and often is seen as controversial, again, because of her commitment to try to tell the stories that aren't being heard. Of course, these are stories being pulled from people in some of these war-torn regions, but it's very difficult oftentimes to sort out some of the confusion and the mess. And certainly we know that Rania has contributed trying to straighten out some of those narratives. And again, listeners can check out your podcast, Unauthorized Disclosure. I think if they just search for it online, they can find Unauthorized Disclosure as a podcast in iTunes. Is that correct, Kevin?
Yeah, that's correct. And also, if you do Google it, you'll get episodes that are posted on Shadowproof.
And that's shadowproof.com. Tell us a little bit about your history there, because you were with FireDog Lake and you are now part of Shadowproof, which has been around for a little while now. But tell our listeners, what's Shadowproof about?
Shadowproof was the organization that I started with my colleague, Brian Sonnenstein. We founded it together. He focuses on prisons, the prison industrial complex, private prisons, and then I regularly post stuff about whistleblowing and all kinds of other stuff. And what we wanted to do is to have a news organization that not only could cover the kinds of work, do the kinds of stories that we were doing at FireDog Lake, but also have a way in which we could support and make relationships with freelancers who might be having an exceptionally difficult time finding places for their work. And since we're a media organization that's not really built around personality. We don't have like a billionaire funding us. We don't have anything of that nature going on. We figure that our budget, the way we want to focus it and the way that we want to get as much mileage as we can out of our work is to look to these writers that are maybe doing critical work, doing exceptional jobs, but they're struggling when they contribute their work to get it accepted, or after it's accepted, they're having trouble getting paid for their work, or they're having issues where the editor is just sitting on their piece and that 2 months have gone by and they don't know when it's going to be published. And so we figure that we've got a pretty good track record so far of working with freelance journalists and starting to grow support. We're aspiring to build the ideal media organization. And we don't claim that we're going to be the best organization or the only organization you read, but we're just trying to struggle through those issues that are really prevalent among independent media right now in terms of trying to last and fund your website and pay people well. And if we can solve some of those issues, and our site uses a membership model where people donate monthly, but they become members, and we really like that model as a way to sustain our journalism.
Interestingly enough, Kevin Gustola, that's the model that we use at Project Censored, Media Freedom Foundation, and also our purpose is to really try to get these great independent journalistic stories and sources and outlets out there to the public so more and more people can turn off corporate media and turn in to this really solid investigative reporting. And that's what you do at shadowproof.com. And again, if our listeners are not familiar, you can check out Kevin Gostola's work at shadowproof.com. And right now on your webpage, you've got a story on movement against prison slavery, a review on the film The Post. You have a piece on taxation is theft. You have some of your interviews here. You have a great protest song of the week with David Rovics, the great folk singer that we've worked with at Project Censored. So again, Shadowproof is a stellar source. It's grown in the last several years, and I encourage listeners to check that out. So Kevin Gustola, let's get into some of the specifics, especially some of the reporting, at least that I know you so well for, and that's your reporting on whistleblowers. Maybe we should go back to Chelsea Manning. You covered it more than I think almost anybody at the time that this was going on. And of course, Chelsea Manning, after being released from prison at the very end of the Obama administration, Chelsea Manning has now announced a run for the Senate in Maryland. So that's a pretty fascinating kind of bookended story there. Can you tell us a little bit about that, or some of the highlights of your reporting on the Manning case and why it's still significant?
The fact that Chelsea Manning is running for the Senate has put Democrats in a very, I think, difficult position. There are quite a few that have remained silent, but she's planning to run against Senator Ben Cardin, who is a establishment senator who's been in office since 2006. And I have a piece that is up at shadowproof.com that people should go read. After they hear this interview, they'll be able to go find it. And one of the things that I find crucial to understanding the reaction is that people think Ben Cardin is probably good enough, that it's just okay for them to have Ben Cardin in as a Democrat. And I think they're very concerned that Chelsea Manning, being the kind of a person she is, who has attracted a lot of attention, and you know, she's going to be raising money, and there's a bit of a celebrity to Chelsea Manning, and I'm not saying that negatively necessarily, but she's able to garner a lot of attention. And she will be putting Democrats in this position where they actually have to defend having Ben Cardin as their senator. And I don't think they like them. They especially don't like that they're going to have to do it against someone who was convicted of felonies for releasing classified information to the public. You know, they're looking at her and they're seeing that there's a perception among the Republican Party and conservatives that she's seen as a traitor. And I think they're very concerned that she's going to run an insurgent, left-leaning campaign against Ben Cardin that they're going to have to actually acknowledge, and it's going to cause them some division and then maybe make them vulnerable to a Republican and I don't know that any of those concerns are even legitimate, but I just raise them because I think that's why you're going to see feverish claims from people. Like one of the people I cite in my piece is Zach Petkanis, who was part of the rapid response team for Hillary Clinton's presidential campaign. And the first thing that came out of Zach's Twitter account when this news was announced was a suggestion that she had given information to a Russian intelligence outfit,
Russiagate, yes.
WikiLeaks. Yeah. And so people needed to be concerned about that. Now, mind you, he was notified immediately by someone that this was 2010. And even if you believe that WikiLeaks has somehow had some kind of interference or collusion or whatever that might be, we're talking 2010. At that point, nobody made any suggestions of the kind. Now, he came back and said that in 2012, Julian Assange went to do a show for Russia Today, and he believes that although that's the only time they were publicly connected, that there must be some kind of grand conspiracy going on that went all the way back to 2010, and somehow Manning is a dupe, and she was involved in it back as early as that. But this, they don't have to have any substance to their conspiracy because the effect will just be to demonize. And they've already made the suggestion that she's running against Ben Cardin because he was involved in some kind of report that really advanced or upped the ante as far as their claims about Russian interference in the Trump administration. And so they're very concerned about her as a candidate.
This from a group of people that are quick to wield the conspiracy theorist weaponized kind of term against those with whom they disagree, much like Donald Trump weaponized the term fake news. But again, a lot of what's going on in the so-called Russia collusion story, it is not of great substance that we've seen in the reporting. And it's another example of how they're wielding this against not just Manning going back to 2010, but also through RT. I recall when one of the reports came out last year that these folks were actually so reaching that they were saying that Abby Martin's program on Russia Today, Breaking the Set, which had been off the air for a couple of years before the election, somehow was the useful idiot and working to cost Hillary Clinton the election. You might recall that.
Well, there's a commonality here. Zach also was front and center when Jill Stein was having to provide documents to
right.
the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and screaming that she was a Russian agent, although there wasn't any proof of that at all. And that's something to consider. And then the other thing I think that's worth considering is the identity aspect, because she's
Indeed.
Transgender and she's going to potentially be vying for that first seat in the Senate as a transgender senator. You know, if she would gain some kind of traction, I really believe that the LGBT community would be in a panic because they wouldn't want the first transgender senator of the United States to be Chelsea Manning, because they were very silent and reserved when her case was unfolding. And very few groups or anybody involved in the LGBT establishment said anything positive about her.
And of course, it's going to be ongoing because Manning has announced a run for Senate in Maryland. But I'm afraid you're correct, Kevin Gustola, that we're going to continue to see these kinds of smears and attacks. Mind you, Manning was sentenced, and none of the people that she outed have seen any kind of justice. There's no cases going to court from the infamous video, the collateral damage video, right? Or the collateral murder video, as it was called, was one of the things that Manning released that clearly shows war crimes, U.S. troops laughing as they shot innocent civilians, journalists, others. Nobody's been brought to justice for this.
Oh, absolutely. And Chelsea called it war porn, I believe, when she was giving her statement. And everything that was revealed there, no one, absolutely no one, has been brought before a court for any torture. She had evidence of assassination squads in these reports. There's nothing around that. You had misconduct among diplomats. You had things with people who were spying on different countries that were supposedly friendly with, and to my knowledge, those people never were fired. There's very little repercussions for anybody as far as the disclosures from Manning go, but of course, she was given a 35-year sentence. And even though the movement that supported her managed to convince President Obama to commute the sentence, and she was given some mercy in that respect.
Yeah, not pardon, but commute.
Yeah.
Right.
So, even though that's the case, she still received a sentence that's actually longer than people receive for, in some cases, really violent crimes like murder, or even in some cases, people who actually do spy as an agent of a foreign power. You know, they've actually had shorter sentences than Manning, who was clearly a whistleblower.
Well, Kevin Gostola, we know you'll continue to be covering what's going on and a piece online at shadowproof.com about the Manning candidacy. I'd like to remind listeners, you're listening to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We're speaking with journalist Kevin Gostola of shadowproof.com, also the Unauthorized Disclosure podcast with Rania Kallak. We'll continue our conversation with Kevin Gostola after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. We continue now our conversation with journalist Kevin Gostola of Unauthorized Disclosure, the podcast with Rania Kallak, a piece included in Censored 2018, highlighting the work of Kevin and Rania. Also, Kevin Gostola writes with shadowproof.com. You can learn more about the work online there. And Kevin, before the break, we were talking about Chelsea Manning and your coverage of her trial and upcoming now Senate race. But you've covered a lot of whistleblowers, including John Curiaco, the CIA torture case, and how he went to prison. Basically, again, another example of somebody that blows the whistle, is imprisoned for blowing the whistle, and none of the people that were outed for breaking other laws ever see any real justice. You're also covering another case, the case of Reality Winner. Could you remind our listeners what's going on with the Reality Winner case? I know you had mentioned a little bit earlier about an upcoming trial, but could you summarize what's happening with this case?
Just to be sure that everyone knows who we're talking about, Reality Winner is a former NSA contractor who's in jail in Georgia right now. And what she did is disclose a top secret, it was marked top secret, report that contained intelligence that the NSA had collected related to potential Russian interference or hacking of the election infrastructure around the 2016 election. And she looked at this document, and according to the interrogation transcript between her and FBI agents, she said that she thought this document should have been public, or at least the contents of it should have been part of the conversation. There was all these daily news reports about Russia and all of these allegations, and she thought, if what I'm reading here is true, we definitely should be talking about the vulnerability of our election infrastructure. So this document was allegedly passed to The Intercept and published. And then when The Intercept ran this report, it wasn't long after that we learned she was arrested and she was going to be charged with violating the Espionage Act, which is the law from World War One era that's been used as like a sledgehammer to basically go after anyone who releases information that they think is in the public interest. And so in her case, what's going on that's most critical right now to follow, I think we need to be mindful that the media isn't covering her case closely and giving us daily updates, even when there are important developments happening. And in particular, I would call people's attention to the fact that she's trying to have the statements during her FBI interrogation suppressed because she was not Mirandized. They never read her rights. The agents and a few others, and they were all armed, she says, came in to her home. They were searching her house. They did have a search warrant, but she was there and she couldn't leave. And they wouldn't tell her if she was going to be arrested, but they were definitely detaining her at that point. And they put her in a position where she ended up incriminating herself, and they never read her her rights. They never asked her if she wanted to have a lawyer present for the interrogation. And so she's challenging that in court. And I think this is different because compared to Chelsea Manning's case, when I look at this, it's hard to talk about reality winner in the same way as Chelsea Manning, because Chelsea Manning was someone who took responsibility for the release of the information. But I believe reality winner sees herself as a whistleblower. But it's a tricky situation where in court, it seems like they're not admitting yet that she actually released this document, because they want to have those statements suppressed so that it'll be harder for the government to prosecute her. So it creates a little bit of gymnastics on the part of me as a journalist discussing her case.
Well, indeed. And of course, listeners can learn more at shadowproof.com, because you have a piece discussing this on the website, and I assume that you're going to be covering this more, given that there's an upcoming trial, and I believe the date of which you mentioned had been moved?
Yeah, it looks like it's going to be moved, but definitely for people who are interested in having in-depth coverage, and if they want the kind of in-depth coverage that I did of Manning, I'm planning to travel to Augusta for the trial when it happens and be there to have the kind of reporting that contrasts with, you know, the New York Times or or CNN, where, you know, the CNN guy might show up and fall asleep during the trial. So you might want to have somebody like me there so you can be sure you figure out what actually happened that day.
That's certainly what stood out in your reporting about Manning, and that's what caught our attention at Project Censored, and just the stories alone that you told around the Manning story. Just your story covering that trial was a story in and of itself, in addition to the Manning case, as a really damning account of corporate media and their lack of interest in covering seriously these types of issues. So, Kevin Gastola, we have a few minutes left in this segment. Again, your reporting about the Manning case was also a great indictment of corporate media because of how they had chosen to cover the case or not cover the case. So your story about the Manning trial is a story in and of itself, meaning in addition to what was going on with Manning. And so on that front, given that you yourself have also been a sharp critic of the shortcomings of corporate news media, you also recently wrote a review of a film that's out now called The Post, about the Washington Post and the Pentagon Papers. And a lot of folks interested in the history of that have seen the film, of course, might be surprised that the film doesn't focus on the whistleblower Daniel Ellsberg, and in fact is a different kind of perspective, and certainly maybe doesn't go into as much detail about the CIA media connections and so on. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your thoughts of The Post, and do you see it as a propaganda piece?
I don't know if I see it as a propaganda piece, but I'll return to that, and I promise to address that. But first, my initial reaction to the movie was that I enjoyed it. I was very taken in by it because overall, stands, and you know, I saw it with, you know, my wife, who doesn't follow this stuff closely, and she walked away excited and thinking, yes, media organizations should publish this. Stand up to the government. You shouldn't let the government dictate what appears in the newspaper. You should exercise your First Amendment rights and stand tall. And so I thought, more than anything, and I also think that optimistically, Daniel Ellsberg in the movie shows up as a positive figure. There isn't any attempt in the film to tear him down or really undermine what he's disclosing, even though he only appears in about 15 minutes of the film. But the thing that I found to be underwhelming about it was just that once you step away from the film, I always knew this story as a New York Times story. I mean, the New York Times is on this case before the Supreme Court. So right. I knew it from the perspective of the New York Times. I lay this out in my review, where I always wondered why you're going to see it from the Washington Post perspective. And basically, I'm not trying to be misogynistic, but basically I've seen that the reason why they decided to do a whole movie that centered around Washington Post publisher Katherine Graham as the central figure of the Pentagon Papers story, or the central way to tell the Pentagon Papers story, was because she was a woman, and because they're very interested in painting her as this brave, courageous person. And this is sort of, I think, just the way that Hollywood is thinking. And again, like it's sort of runs into the same pitfalls that people ran into in wholly supporting Hillary Clinton's campaign, unquestionably, without looking at her flaws as a Democratic politician. And so when I look at the film, I see that as part of why we're not just telling the story of Ellsberg, or why we're not just telling the story of the New York Times, is because they wanted a woman that they could follow as the central character. But in doing that, you have to deal with the fact that Katherine Graham, not to mention Ben Bradley, are both people who have connections to the CIA. You know, Graham is friends with Robert McNamara and is having social events and dinners with him on a regular basis. And now her paper is going to be in a position where they need to make a decision whether they're going to publish the Pentagon Vietnam study. And she's compromised. She's not someone who can really say yes or no to this because she's worried she's going to lose a friend. And so that's critical. But the one thing I'll point out quickly that I don't think everyone might get when they watch the film is that I saw this as a very clear cautionary tale against access journalism. And I know that's not the film that Steven Spielberg intended to create, but knowing what I know about media, if you watch it and pay attention to what's going on, it's really staggering how the Washington Post is so inept and incapable of engaging in investigative journalism that they really don't know how to compete with the New York Times and the fact that they're going to blow open the story. And if a couple things don't happen, if I believe that Ellsberg called them the Lavender Group or whatever, if they had come in and dumped documents on the table and gave them to one of the Post reporters, or if Ben Bagdikian hadn't known that Ellsberg was the one who was releasing these documents, I don't know how they ever would have managed to hold court against the New York Times. Because at that point, they were concerned that they weren't getting access to Trisha Nixon's wedding.
You know, we could certainly bring that up to the present when both of those papers seem to have sunk to new depths with Bezos, Jeff Bezos, and the Washington Post and their CIA contracts, and the mighty Wurlitzer plays on, as Frank Weisner would say. But definitely, I encourage people to read your review, and you certainly bring up the CIA and Mockingbird and the mighty Wurlitzer. And again, certainly some juicy quotes from Graham, too, including in promotion of secrecy and allowing the elite newspapers to decide what the public maybe should or should not be allowed to see. Kevin Gostola, shadowproof.com and unauthorized disclosure. I wanted to thank you not only for your work, the important work you do, and the work you're doing with Rania Kallak as well, but thanks for taking time to join us on the Project Censored Show. We definitely will be having you back on the program later on this year. Thanks, Kevin Gostola.
Thank you.
Supporting human conditions, not free market propaganda and corrupt politicians, because they own by special interest groups that fund their campaign.
And that does it for another episode of the Project Censored Show. I'm your host, Mickey Huff. I'm also executive producer of the program with Peter Phillips. The Project Censored Show was founded in 2010. Our senior producer is Anthony Fest. Our producer from KPCA in Petaluma is Dennis Murphy. Our engineer is Erica Bridgman. To learn more, listen to past broadcasts, and to support Project Censored and this program, please visit us online at projectcensored.org. You can further support the program via Patreon or through our website. Please follow and like us on Facebook and Twitter at Project Censored. Thanks so much for listening. We'll be back next week.
Political ties, habitual lies, alibis, disguise, another guy's democracy, politics, and the apocalypse, got the skies like an ominous.